Since we're about four topics behind, I was asked if we have a plan, and the answer is yes. We're not going to divulge that plan yet, but we have a plan, which includes speaking very fast. The first topic for this afternoon is a discussion of two-way communications and a requirement that was added in the proposed standard that's not in the existing auditing standard for the auditor to evaluate the effectiveness of the two-way communications between the auditor and the audit committee. Board member Bill Gradison is going to make some introductory comments on this issue.
Thank you very much. Just one personal comment, and then I'll get right down to business. I suppose as a regulator, my job is to regulate, but I have to say I'm troubled by the philosophy behind the staff proposal, because there's nothing in this standard that an audit committee can't get now if they ask for it. Nothing. It would suggest to me that maybe the challenge here is education. I mean, perhaps we could accomplish the goal by the issuance of an audit alert or something, and then encourage the auditors to share the alert with the members of the committees and get past some of these difficulties of definition. But that's a personal thing. That's not why I was asked to start this thing off. But I do get to vote on it if I'm not replaced before we... Those comments in no way lessen the value of effective two-way communication, and it's important in assisting the auditor and the audit committee in understanding significant matters, however we define them, related to the audit. On matters of material misstatements or concerns about accounting and auditing matters, the discussion might contribute to audit quality. I have been struck by the discussion so far. I think I'm the first one to use the term audit quality. I may have missed something earlier, but since that's what we're in the business of encouraging, I think that might be even be a significant observation. The board included a requirement in the proposed standard for the auditor to evaluate the adequacy of the two-way communication between the auditor and the audit committee, to emphasize that effective two-way communications are beneficial to achieving the objectives of the audit. You know, I think it's kind of striking that our goal is effective two-way communications, but we're going to do this without two-way evaluation. The evaluation of the audit committee is going to be made by the auditor, but nothing is coming back the other way. Now, there's a reason for that, because that's up to the SEC. That's not within our purview. But it has led me to think that since our role is limited to the auditor side and the SEC's a very comprehensive role includes not only oversight and approval of whatever we do, but also the role with regard to the issuer, the board, the audit committee. I have wondered whether we would be better off in the long run if this project moves forward, if it were done jointly with the SEC. In other words, if they were moving something parallel that had to do with the responsibilities of the audit committee, for example, evaluating the communication from the audit committee's point of view, which we can't do at the same time we were doing it from the other direction. In any event, the purpose of the upcoming discussion is to seek feedback from all of you regarding the importance of effective two-way communication and how and or whether these requirements before us should be modified to support the objectives of the audit.
Thanks, Bill. And there were some questions to that in that regard in the briefing paper, which pretty much went to what Bill has just said, and that is, how important is effective two-way communications to the audit committee's responsibility and the oversight of the audit? If it is important, how can the requirements and the proposed standard be modified to promote effective two-way communication? Additionally, considering that the PCAOB does not have oversight of audit committees, what other ways can the board promote effective two-way communication without being able to impose requirements on the audit committee? I should add that when we were thinking about proposing this as a standard, we had a discussion with our SAG, and the SAG felt that promoting effective two-way communications was a very important part of any standard we might put out. And so that was certainly in our thought processes as we issued this proposed standard. Some of the other questions are, how could the requirement for the auditor's evaluation of whether the communications with the audit committee have been adequate be modified to support the objectives of the audit? And finally, which came up in some of the comments, should the auditor's evaluation of effective two-way communications be expanded to include an evaluation of the communications between management and the audit committee? Bob Kippers, I think you're going to begin the discussion here.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. And I don't want to alarm the group, but I've actually been thinking about this. Let me just remind you quickly what the paragraphs 26 through 28 require, and it's under the rubric of adequacy of two-way communications, as we just teed up. But as you go through it, to Board Member Gradison's point, this is really a one-way evaluation. It does not require any evaluation of the audit committee of how well the auditor is communicating. So it leads me to believe that the entirety of it will rest on the auditor's perception of whether they're getting the information they need to complete the objectives of their audit, of their examination. And if you take it the full distance through paragraph 28, it goes to, okay, what happens if the communications have not been adequate? And it tees up a couple possibilities, communicating with the full board, perhaps a scope limitation in your opinion, or the ultimate vote with your feet, withdrawing from the engagement. As I look at this and just take the construction of those paragraphs and forget the title for a minute, this actually works pretty well if you change it to say, consequences on the engagement of inadequate audit committee communication. In other words, what is an auditor to do if they're not getting the engagement they need from the audit committee? Either they're unwilling to talk about fraud risk, they're withholding information that you somehow through your corroboration find out was an issue that they were aware of. All of these things would be very concerning to an auditor. If that were, I know that's not your objective in the standard, Marty, but if that were the title of the section and you did a little tweaking, it would all make sense to me. You know, these are the kinds of things you'd look at. If you become aware that you're not receiving adequate communication from your client, from the audit committee, there are consequences to that, and these are the steps you might take. And the first one, while it's viewed as an option or should consider, to me would be mandatory, as it would if I were having difficulty with management, is to communicate with the full board. To me, that's step number one. If the audit committee is not working with you, next place I go is the full board. If management wasn't working with us, the first place I go is the audit committee. And I don't think that should... I think that's absolutely necessary. Now, where it goes from there could ultimately determine whether you ever get to an opinion, whether you have to modify your opinion, or hopefully you would resolve the issue. My point is, as I look through all the comments from some analyses that I saw, you know, investor comment letters, auditors, corporate governance folks on boards, I really didn't see any group that embraced this as a meaningful additional element. But it might be helpful, from an auditor's standpoint again, if there were some specificity about consequences once you concluded. I mean, you might have some indicia of inadequate communications and say, if you conclude they're not adequate, then these are the things you either must do or should consider. So as I looked at this, it struck me that this really had little to do about two-way communications, and the most important thing is, what's the end of the story on my engagement if there's this problem?
Thank you, Bob. And Karen Hastie-Williams.
Thank you. As important is for the board to make an evaluation about a particular issue, you're hearing one perspective from the person making the presentation, but do you see other issues and do you want some feedback from other parts of the corporation or the company that you're dealing with? And I think that's something that audit committees should feel open to raise issues and to get as much information as they can. And whether it comes from the external auditor or internal auditor, I think that the issue is you want your board to have as much information as they can absorb with respect to an issue. And I agree with you that if you're not getting cooperation from particular individuals or officers in the company, then you go to the CEO and say, look, this is important to us. We need to get this information. So I think that's the way that I would interpret that.
I'm sorry, Linda Griggs.
Thank you. I find this part of the standard very confusing. The release talks about the promotion of effective two-way communications as a goal, but then paragraph 3 tees up this evaluation of the audit committee. And I'm confused about how this effectiveness of the audit committee two-way communication relates to internal control over financial reporting. There's a very effective mechanism, it seems to me, for the evaluation of the audit committee's oversight or the board when there's no audit committee through the audit of ICFR. Now, I recognize with Dodd-Frank we've got a slightly different issue there, and I don't know, I haven't thought through how it would affect small businesses, but it does seem to me that the mechanism now in place to evaluate oversight is an appropriate one. If, in fact, there's a concern about the effectiveness of two-way communications, does that mean that there is a material weakness in internal control over financial reporting? If so, I'd like to see AS5 revised. I think AS5 should provide the guidance. If, in fact, we now think that rather than the audit committee's role being incidental, which is the way Auditing Standards 380 talks about the audit communications as being incidental to the audit, we now think these two-way communications are critical, then I think we need to be a little bit clearer about that in the standard. I think the standard should be to promote effective two-way communications. I agree completely with Bob. If there is a problem with those communications, the auditor needs to go immediately, as soon as he discovers the problem, to the board of directors. If the board of directors doesn't do something, then I think, you know, the consequences are you've got ineffective internal control, because clearly there is not an oversight mechanism to the financial reporting process, and then maybe the auditor needs to resign because they can't be comfortable with that they can even conduct an audit. But I think the consequences, I think that the consequences laid out in paragraph 28 are really not the focus that the standard should have. I think the standard should be focused on promoting this communication, and if there's a problem, have a discussion. And maybe actually I was wrong. Maybe the first discussion is the auditor sits down with the audit committee and says, look, we don't think we're really getting this free flow of discussion. We think that's the best way to assure that the financial reporting process works first. So that's really the first step. If that doesn't work, then you go to the board. If that doesn't work, all right, then there isn't effective oversight, it seems to me. But I do think we need to somehow integrate AS5 with this standard if you're going to leave the effectiveness in here, because I just think it's very confusing. Is this yet another standard? Is this the same as AS5? Thanks.
Thanks, Linda, for those for those comments. let me just make a brief comment, and then I want to pass it on to Barbara. I think your points are good ones and raise interesting challenges for us as we look at the standard. I think, as I said in my opening comments, it clearly was a strong point from our standing advisory group that this standard promote effective two-way communications. So an interesting comment I'll be glad to be trying to hope to hear from others would be, are there other ways in which this standard might be able to promote effective two-way communications other than the manner in which we've done it in the standard so far. So I'd be interested in further comments in that regard. Barbara, maybe you could just comment very briefly on the intersection between this and AS5.
Sure. Thank you, Marty. Yeah, just to follow up, I guess in the SAS view, this requirement is more narrow than the assessment of the control environment that, the auditor would do as part of an integrated audit in AS5. The standard does refer the auditor back to AS5 if the auditor were to determine that the communications haven't been adequate. For this standard, it's really just a part of your overall assessment in AS5. Just a couple other points to note. This standard would apply to all audits, whether they would be integrated audits or audits of smaller issuers that would not be subject to AS5. So this really, I think, is just, is not anywhere near the full scope of AS5.
Thanks, Barbara. George Munoz?
Thanks, Marty. In terms of another alternative, I would say that, first of all, promoting two-way communication is crucially important. So another way is to simply, if you want to put a standard on the auditors, simply require the auditors to request an executive session at the audit committee, period. And in that executive session, then the auditor should do all of the best practices, all of the kinds of things that are important, because in that way, that's the only time that's one way that the auditor can force issues, bring up issues, and see the reaction or the like. Instead of this other way, which I think is more complicated. So let me address a few things that are in this communication. But before I do, I don't get many opportunities to speak to the PCAOB, so let me expand on this opportunity. I actually look at PCAOB as a very good check mechanism for the audit committees. That is, if the audit committees know that somebody's auditing the auditors, that is, that the auditors are meeting high levels of certification, qualification, training, education, that there's competition in the profession, that there's more people in the pipeline, that the schools are teaching the right things, that's great for the audit committee. Somebody's taking care of that. We know it's not the SEC. We know it's not the Congress. We know it's not everything else. But the PCAOB, to me, is a wonderful opportunity. So the reason why this is relevant is because I have to gauge the priorities and importance of what's before us against what I, as from the audit committee, would look to. For example, IFRS, the position that PCAOB it has to speak up on IFRS. It has to, because that is going to affect how audits are done and what is looked for and the like, and therefore, to me, that's a higher priority. I'm not saying you're not, but I'm just saying I would hope that this kind of conference is held on that. On competition, there's only four major companies. I would love to have the PCAOB speak to, is there enough competition in there so that we have more auditors to work with? Are they prepared? Are they well trained? Are the colleges teaching what they're doing? So in that context, as I look at this rule, I say, all right, so now we're putting a standard out there. Is this the kind of thing that I expect the PCAOB to give some precedence to? I look at item number 10 in communications, which is, let me get to it. 10 says, the auditor should communicate the following matters to the audit committee. That means I'm going to have to put it on the agenda, or it's going to take up time. And here's item number A, the auditor's determination of whether persons with specialized skill or knowledge are needed for the audit. Well, of course, I would hope that the auditor is always going to use a special skill, special person, but he doesn't have to take up the audit committee's agenda time to tell us that he's going to call on some special skill. He's got us. We look to the auditor to do that. The second item is, and this is on the agenda again, the auditor's consideration of and plan use of the company's internal audit function. That's a judgment call. These are things that are now the PCAOB is requiring that there be communication on. So is that the two-way communication? I'm sorry, but it doesn't rise to the level of importance for what that audit committee's fiduciary responsibility is. I go to item number 15, and it says management consultations with other accountants. When the auditor is aware that management consulted with other accountants about auditing or accounting matters is a lot, the auditor should communicate to the audit committee his or her views about significant matters that were the subject of such consultation. Why? I don't see the relevance unless the auditor thinks that a particular discussion maybe is of relevant, but this requires that they do it pretty much regardless of whatever they consider to be significant. So if these were not requirements but rather considerations, I would be supportive of it. So then I go to your question, which is 26. So in paragraph 26, it requires that somehow the auditor evaluate this two-way communication, and that evaluation is going to be in writing, it's going to be the like, and it's almost like the audit committee is the one who's hiring, if you will, engaging the auditor, and yet the auditor is going to, quote, report on the audit committee. I wonder what, how that plays in people's minds, because that auditor is going to be writing some report card, if you will. And I don't know if that's the way it should be. I'd like the audit committee to be writing the report card on the auditor, and I'm not sure that it should work the other way around. Not to say that that's not relevant. So I would say I would substitute all of this with one standard that says auditors, in any case where any of these things exist, should request an executive session with the audit committee and speak to that issue.
Thanks, George. Don Nicolaisen?
I think when you get to the area of effective communication, it's a tough area. I think of the businessman who wants a one-page memorandum that cuts to the chase of what's important, what are the decision points, and what do we need to deal with. I think of the general that gave a 28-page memo to his superior that had a covering comment that said, I'm sorry, this memo is 28 pages. I didn't have time to reduce it to one. What we've been talking about today is very complicated communications from the auditor to the audit committee that goes on for pages and pages and pages. Typically, of the ones that I see, they're 50 to 100 pages. Not all of that is of equal importance. Not of all of it I would think of as conveyance of communications or effective communications. And so I think part of the problem starts there of how do you have effective communication if one of the requirements is a bookload of information that gets dumped on the audit committee with a view that that's the communication from the auditor. Now is the communication back from the audit committee something that can be effectively evaluated? I watch my son, and his buddies will come over. One of them will look up, three of them will grunt, and they'll all go because they know exactly what they're going to do. I see my son talk to his girlfriend for hours, and then I see his girlfriend come to mom and say, I'm not sure we're communicating. And so what is effective communication? How do you get there, and how do you measure it? And if you're asking this party that writes 50-page documents, is the communication from the other side effective? I'm not sure they're the right people to be asking that question. And then you get into, well, should we have somebody who's actually a moderator who can help the audit committee talk to the auditor? And I don't think we want to go there. So my view is, pretty much, I think what I've heard others express, effective communication is necessary, it's desirable, should be encouraged, but I don't think you can write rules that say, if you do this, this, and this, you've had effective communication, because I think you can still fail miserably.
Thanks, Don. Mike Cook?
Marty, thank you. Maybe a little bit along the lines of what Don was suggesting, but then I have a question also at the end. I'm kind of the same place. I could see putting a requirement in place for the auditors to obtain an evaluation of their effectiveness as communicators from the audit committee. I don't quite understand why we would empower and through a standard require auditors to evaluate the effectiveness of somebody else communicating with them. In the ordinary sense, I can understand if there's a breakdown, you need to talk to people and you need to have open dialogue, and I'm all in favor of promoting communication. It'd be un-American not to be in favor of promoting communication, but if the burden is on anybody here, we ought to put the burden on the firm to obtain an evaluation of its effectiveness, not the other way around. And I think this is just ass backwards, excuse the French. And I mean, and I don't think it's going to be effective. And it's another requirement added on top of others that I don't think is going to stimulate better things, but it will certainly take more time, more cost, and I don't know what you get at the end of the day. I did have one question, however. What we have here all seems to be talking about communication in a non-litigious, non-threatened environment, and that is the way the world should be 98% of the time. But when you get into special investigations and matters of that type, you get into some very tricky issues of privilege, issues of timing of public disclosure. And there are times when it's appropriate for there to be two-way communication. And there are other times when people are not free to have two-way communications in advance of other things taking place. I don't know if you can make that distinction if you choose to retain this notion, but somewhere it ought to say that these broad and general rules about evaluating communication, and if you don't get back what you want, you do what Bob Koepper said you're going to do, you think about whether you have to quit and all those kind of things. Some of those rules don't work well in a special investigation type situation where the audit committee is working with outside counsel and there's counsel engaged for the audit committee itself, not for the company, not for other people, and not for the purpose of informing the auditors. And the audit committee understands you got to keep them informed, you can't shut them out, but you don't just invite them in to these highly private sessions prematurely. And so I don't know if you can make that distinction, but somewhere this can't be just a general rule that says Bob Koepper should come visit me in the midst of a special investigation and tell me he wants to know everything that's going on, because that doesn't work. And Bob would be, having been involved in a number of them, he'd be the first one to recognize it.
Thanks for those clear and unambiguous comments, Mike. next, we have Alex Mendel.
Well, ditto to Mike, frankly. He took the words right out of my mouth. I think it is backwards, candidly. I mean, we talked about the three-legged stool earlier and the balance of that, the necessary balance of the three-legged stool, and I think this would actually, you know, throw it off balance, would offset that balance in a way that could actually impair or impede the communications that are so important. And I fully agree. I mean, communications between those two groups are critical, and if they don't go well, you know, something has to happen. There's no doubt about that. You know, the governance committee can get involved if something doesn't go right. I mean, there are some other means, but to have the authority for the auditor to give a report on the audit committee, which has implications, you know, of various kinds, I think is in balance, throws the whole system out of balance, and is I would urge us not to do that.
There's a number of other cards up, but I would want to ask a question. Maybe Bob Kippers or Sam possibly could add some insight into this. If you can't, then I'll continue with the rest of the cards. But this is a requirement in the international standards on auditing under the IAASB. Communications with audit committees has this same requirement. I'm wondering, can you shed any light as to whether this is working in any effective way on audits outside U.S. jurisdictions where this requirement exists already or not?
That's clearly a Sam Renzilla question.
I don't have an answer to either of those. I have not, Marty. I would couch this with, it's a question I did not ask in either preparing, helping our guys prepare a response or preparing for today. I have not heard any noise out of the system that would lead me to believe that this has been a significant issue. You know, I think it's important to recognize. I don't dispute any, and quite frankly, I don't feel real strongly on this particular whether it's in or it's out, because auditors already today are required under AS5 to consider the effectiveness of an audit committee in its assessment as to whether or not internal controls are effective. This is just one slice of the effectiveness of, a, of an audit committee. But already that system exists where an auditor is making an assessment. And quite frankly, when AS2 came out, you know, we had some chuckles thinking that's going to work really well. Those are going to be some interesting conversations if you determine the only material weakness your client has are the people you're delivering that message to. So, I don't think that has been an impediment to effective communication. And again, I mean, we believe audit committees are really important in the conduct of our audits, and I don't think that's gotten in the way of it. So I'd be happy to get back with you with an answer. Unfortunately, I won't be able to share it with everybody, but I'd be happy to follow up on that if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Because again, like in other aspects of this, trying to get further information about how it's working elsewhere or what other things are working is always is useful to know. But as you point out very appropriately, AS5 does require the auditor to evaluate the audit committee in connection with internal control of a financial reporting, and this is, if you will, an element of that. Bob Gore?
It just strikes me as we're having this discussion that perhaps evaluating effectiveness of two-way communication really is somewhat of a fancy way of asking for two separate evaluations. It seems to me that the audit committee needs to evaluate whether or not they are receiving the information they need from the auditors, and I don't think there's much argument about that. At the same time, as an auditor, I don't think it's inappropriate for an evaluation to be made of whether the audit committee is responsive and provides the auditor information that may be relevant to the conduct of the audit going forward. I'm not sure that's all wrapped up in something we can call effective two-way communication, but perhaps if there was more of a spin to it, of both parties need to evaluate whether or not the information required to discharge their individual responsibilities are being obtained, that information is being obtained throughout the engagement, would be a better way to go about it. For example, in Mike's situation with the ongoing special investigation, you know, one could argue that if Mike responded that he couldn't discuss something, that we had not had effective two-way communication. But I think what's more relevant is that the auditor understand the ramifications to the conduct of the audit and the outcome from Mike being in the position that he is at that current time as an audit committee member. So I wonder if there's a way that we could accomplish, I think, what we're all aiming to get at here without trying to wrap it around something that's as nebulous as sons talking to girlfriends and trying to evaluate whether communication has been effective or not.
Thank you. There's two more cards up that is part of our grand plan to get back on schedule. If we can limit the discussion on this particular question to the two cards that are up, Joan Wagoner and then finally Lynn Turner. Thanks.
Oh, thanks very much, Marty. I think in terms of our practice and the smaller company practice, the issue really kind of drills down what would be on our big wish list here. Our big wish list basically is to understand or to have the audit committee understand is, do they feel that it is their responsibility if they become aware of something that affects financial reporting or the internal controls over financial reporting, that they have an obligation to share that with the external auditors? And in my view, I think they do. I think most people would agree that they do. I don't know that all audit committees feel that way, especially in the smaller companies. So that is my big focus in terms of evaluating two-way communication, or the one big thing that I would like to see a bit more solidly placed in terms of a communication between the audit committee and the external auditor. Thank you.
Good, thanks. And Lynn?
Marty, I think the correct term for this is an upward evaluation, and companies like General Electric have used upward evaluations for years very successfully. I have twice on audit committees of public entities used an evaluation where we not only evaluated the auditor, but we actually had the auditor do a formal evaluation of the audit committee. And at the start of the audit each year, everyone knew that we'd be evaluating them, and we also told them they'd be evaluating us, so we asked them to take a look at what we're doing, and if we weren't doing things right or could do it better, we'd want to know about that, and the evaluation provided them an opportunity to do that. In both those instances, it actually had a very significant positive impact on the communication between the two sides, and actually probably impacted the timing of that communication and brought some of it forward, if you will. So I've found from my experience where we've actually done these type of evaluations, it has been very positive. I also think that an auditor, the audit committee just plays a phenomenally important role in the financial reporting process. There's just no question about that, no denying that. And with that, the audit committee oversees not just the auditor, but that audit committee oversees the internal auditors, oversees the financial management that we've all talked about, and is a critical, very important control here. And if you're an auditor, I look at these four questions, and the actual standard says the auditor is just going to evaluate. It doesn't say you're going to issue any type of special report. So all it does is say the auditor is going to go evaluate that extremely important piece of the overall control. And it's not just to do with the audit, but it's to do with some other very significant parts of the financial reporting process. And I look through the four questions: appropriateness and timeliness of actions taken by this very important audit committee, the openness of it to communicate with the auditor. I mean, if the audit committee will not communicate with them, I as an auditor would probably have some grave concerns. The willingness and capacity of the audit committee to meet with them in executive session, if they won't do that, there's got to be a problem. These are very plain Jane, very simple, basic things that are not that difficult. And the fourth question, the extent to which the audit committee probes issues raised by the auditor. I, you know, as an investor, I certainly hope the audit committees are doing that. If not, we're probably wasting some of our money on those board of director fees. So they're very simple things, and it just says the auditor's going to go through and evaluate those things and come to a conclusion about where that very significant control is working adequately or not. And so to say there's an issue with that, I think tells you just from a common sense perspective we're missing something in the system. And if we're so worried as audit committee members about the auditor looking at those things, then there's probably a bigger issue here that we don't have on the table. So I think what's here is fine. I've done it before, and it's worked well. And if anything, it enhanced and brought the communications to an earlier stage and was very beneficial for us on the audit committee, and I think benefited the auditor as well. So I think it's a very, very solid, very simple, very easy thing to do, and something that as an auditor I can't comprehend how you wouldn't do it anyway.
Did you do the did you do it more than 1 year, or is it just a 1 year deal?
Yeah, the way we actually started this out, the first time I did it was when I was a CFO, Hal, and to Don's question, I wanted to find out if the auditor thought this was really a good audit to work on, so I required that the auditor, including the staff that actually had to work on the audit, the junior staff even, to fill out an evaluation. And you never know, you know, when you do that, you're sitting here going, am I setting myself up just to get the bejesus beat out of me or not? But if it was, I wanted to know. And I figured it was better to manage the issue and know about it if there was one, rather than not know it. So we did it for several
years as the CFO, and then on the audit committee, yeah, we did it each year then. It just became part of the evaluation process. And after the first year, what I found was that butterfly feeling in your stomach about how this is going to turn out after the first year, and I did have those concerns, it always went away. The communication just became very natural. You know, it just, no one gave it a second thought after that. It just became part of what you did.
Thanks, Lynn. One more comment from
I just want to ask one question. At least the audit committees that I'm on, there's a client satisfaction process that goes both ways, which is maybe not as direct as this, but it is more comprehensive, deals with all the issues and tends to surface things, and there's no mention of that any place. Is that, I just wouldn't, if you have a process that works and it's effective, I'm not sure that you need to introduce another one, and at least if that's done comprehensively, you might want to, at least in here, if you decide to go ahead with a requirement, that you acknowledge there may be other ways to accomplish the same objective.
Great, thank you very much.
The only point was there ought to be some mutuality on how this process works, and I guess what you're describing is a mutual process, but what this says, at least the way I read it, this is a one-way process, and that was my main concern with the OHG stuff here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate a lot of very constructive input on a interesting topic that was introduced into this standard that was not in the existing standard. So thank you for all of the good feedback. Another topic where we had a lot of comments, again, was whether communication should be written or oral. And again, this was led by a lot of discussions at our SAG meeting, again, with some very strong views from our SAG members about this topic. So, Jennifer, why don't I turn this to you?
Yes, thank you, Marty. Actually, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Gelser, who's agreed to provide some opening remarks.
Okay, thanks, Jennifer. Like the existing standards, the board's proposal would allow the auditor, with a few exceptions, to choose between written or oral communication of the information that he or she is required to communicate to the audit committee. And as Jennifer suggested, we did ask for comment on whether that was the appropriate approach. Views were quite sharply split. While there were exceptions, I would say that in general, auditors favored the idea of continuing their flexibility to choose between written or oral communication. On the other hand, audit committees and investors tended to support the idea that the required communication should be in writing. The proponents of written communication argue that writing provides a record that permits committee members to refer back to what was communicated and avoids the risk of future disputes or misunderstanding. Writing, we were told, is also a more effective way to communicate complex information about topics like critical accounting estimates. Moreover, people pointed out that written communication is more efficient since committee members can consider the information at any time and then use their time at committee meetings with the auditor to ask questions. In contrast, those who urged flexibility pointed out that a choice between written and oral communication allows the auditor to determine what's going to work best based on the facts and circumstances and what will best lead to open communication. In some cases, oral communication may also be more consistent with candor, and oral communication minimizes the risk that points will simply be communicated as boilerplate in writing. So we're hoping that the roundtable will give us some insight into how we ought to resolve this split in views. I would point out that all communications that are required would have to be memorialized in the work paper, so there would be a record of what was communicated from a work paper perspective. But beyond that, whether the communications themselves should be written or oral, appreciate your views on what would be most effective. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. We have three discussion questions here, and these questions are intended to probe further, trying to get behind the reasons. If you think it should be in writing, what are those reasons? Or orally, if it's made orally, then what are the reasons to continue with that? So let me go through the questions, and we'll get into the discussion. First one is, should all matters be communicated by the auditor to the audit committee, be in writing, or only certain matters? If only certain matters should be communicated to the audit committee in writing, what are those matters? And this is getting the last one. What are the risks of allowing some of the communications to be made orally? So if you're in the camp that you believe all communications should be in writing, why do you have that? What risk do you perceive would be out there if some of them are made orally? Next question. So if the standard required all communications to be in writing, should the auditor document oral discussions that relate to such written communications? So we've heard today about robust dialogue and open discussions. If you're someone that believes everything should be in writing, then what's your view on those open, robust dialogue? Does that mean that the auditor should go back and document exactly what was said in those oral discussions? Is that what you're intending as well, if you believe everything should be in writing? Next question. If all required communications to the audit committee were required to be in writing, would there be any effect on the dialogue between the auditor and the audit committee? Would the dialogue on key matters continue to be robust? In other words, would those discussions still be open and frank? Or would there be some concern, if I've got to document everything, then, you might not want to have, pass along something that you think is a harsh evaluation, but it for fear because it's in writing or how that might be interpreted. So would there be any effect? Would it chill, if you will, some of the conversations if everything you said needed to be in writing? Ask Diane Nikolaisen to provide some opening views to open up the discussion, and then we'll open up to everyone. So, Don?
Great. I think the issues have been well described, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your comments. And I'm somewhat indifferent whether the communication is in oral form or writing for the most part. But when you come to a standard that requires all significant communication to be documented, and part of it is shared, documented, this to me means you've written it. And so if you've written it down and you share only a portion of that written piece with the audit committee, and then another portion is maintained somewhere else and the audit committee is not aware that those things were considered significant by the auditor because they were communicated in a different format and perhaps the writing was different than the actual discussion took place. I could imagine situations where certain people are tepid about raising difficult issues, but they're not hesitant to put in a memo that I raised it and I discussed it, even though it might have been very cryptic in its explanation. And so that's my primary concern with this, and I'll leave it with that.
Thank you, John. I don't see any other 10 cards, but we did get significant views. Here's Linda. Linda Griggs.
I just had a question. I mean, what are you contemplating PCAOB would need to then be documented in the work papers? I guess I need to understand what the purpose for that documentation is, and would that have to be very extensive, or is it just we had a discussion about, the CFO's transgressions, and that would be it? I mean, how detailed would that then have to be? What the standard says, it's to enable an experienced auditor to understand that the communications were made to comply with the provisions of the standard. Well, it might be enough to just say we had this very difficult discussion. But if it has to get into the details, then I guess I'm with Don. I'd want to know what those details were. If it's going to be written down, it seems to me that's something the audit committee should be aware of.
Well, I'll I'll take a shot at responding to that. Again, we had lengthy discussions at the SAG meeting, and many of the SAG representatives thought that requiring all communications to be in writing would stifle some of the natural dialogue that takes place among the auditor and the audit committee. And so in drafting this, we decided to permit the matters to be communicated either in writing or orally. However, we felt that certainly from an inspection perspective, if nothing else, if the communications were made orally, we would have no idea whether or not the communications were made or what they might be. And so we established a requirement that if they are made orally, they would at least have to be documented to the extent that somebody, an experienced auditor, having no previous connection with the engagement, could understand the communications in sufficient detail to know essentially what would be communicated if the required communications were made in writing. So the essence would be they could be made in writing, or if for one reason or another, if the committee and the auditor decided that some of the communications would be made orally, that we at least felt that the substance and the importance of that still needed to be documented in the auditor's work papers such that we could understand that the objectives of this standard were met by being able to read that documentation. Now, I understand the point that Don's raising is, well, then I, as an audit committee member, if you didn't send me the written report, well, then maybe send me the memorandum that went to your files, because I might not agree with how you characterize them. I think is the issue here.
If I could also add, I think when we were drafting that language, we were also considerate of the fact that the engagement quality reviewer needs to be able to determine that the engagement team has complied with the standard, and these are matters that are very important for that reviewer maybe to be aware of also.
Well, and I also just want to point out that the way our standard is drafted now, about if it's made orally, then you document your work papers, that exists in the standard today. So that isn't a new concept that we would be adding. The auditors have that today.
Lisa Gaynor?
A few years ago, I took part of this research synthesis team, and we were asked to address this very issue as to which these questions, and look to the academic literature to see what had been done. And what we had discovered is nothing had been done in this area, specifically in accounting and auditing. However, we did make the statement that in communication, and there's called communication richness theory. And here we keep talking about oral versus written, and we've heard throughout this morning that there's so much information that's put in writing, the reports of 50 to 100 pages, that clearly we don't want to add more written information just so it's documented. But if you go to theory would say that we should be talking not necessarily about oral versus written, but about the richness of a communication versus the leanness of the communication. So you've got the distinction here maybe between effectiveness and the efficiency of a communication. More complex, I mean, it's pretty simple, more complex thoughts and messages should be in a richer format. And a richer format isn't necessarily, it's usually face-to-face where you can see expressions, as you were saying, that as Don was saying, that we discussed this during a meeting, and then they go to they kind of just like skirted the issue in the meeting, but then they get into the documentation stage. And so a rich format would include both a face-to-face or an oral, if that's how you choose to call it, as well as a written format as well, or just even including the face-to-face. It's not even just oral, because you get into looking at people and seeing expressions and making your own intuitions from there. So more complex, more rich, less complex, meaner. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Lynn Turner?
Marty, on the committees I've sat on, we have asked auditors give it to us in writing, and they've used graphs, or it's taken various forms, whatever worked best for everyone involved. So I think you got to give flexibility to that. Some of this can be graph better than it can in just a written word. So I'm a big fan of putting it in writing. I get very nervous about the point that Don raised about something sitting in the audit work papers about me as the audit committee that I've never seen before that talks about what they were telling me in a conversation. There's just something about that I don't like. And so I'm a strong supporter of having it in writing. The Blue Ribbon Panel Committee on Audit Committees recommended this type of stuff be in writing, and there was actually some language in it that I think is very good that I'd suggest you consider. It says, this requirement should be written in a way to encourage open, frank discussion and to avoid boilerplate. And I think having a sentence in there like that, even if you leave it optional, is very good to put that in there, because I think that's what you're trying to get at.
Thanks, Lynn. If I can follow up, so if all of the communications are in writing, and as you know, of course, then there's a robust dialogue, and oftentimes there's further inquiry by the audit committee about what the auditor meant by something that he or she put into writing. And if there's additional, obviously, explanations by the auditor about the matters during the committee meeting, would you expect then that those matters would also be then documented in writing and further shared with the audit committee or not?
Oh, I can think most recently of a conversation about what the auditor documented on the quality of the accounting practices, the very key critical accounting policies, and where they set the line. And in that particular case, there was one audit committee member disagreed with the auditor's assessment, and at the following meeting, there was follow-up by the auditor on that particular point. So, you know, I think it depends upon what the particular situation is as to what goes with it. I think some of Denny's comments are very relevant in this area. I don't think you want to get a 100-page document necessarily here. I think you want to get a document that really focuses on the key things. And again, I think a lot of your questions, a lot of your points are very key things, so I think they'll flow. But you don't want to have it turning into a CYA document. You want to have it turned into a real dialogue between the audit committee and the auditor. And then if there's things that are set up for follow-up, then so be it. In that particular board, we had a standard process for if something was like that got teed up, we would note it in a section of the audit committee minutes or the board minutes, a note for follow-up, and the first thing we did at the next board meeting or audit committee meeting was always take on the follow-up items, because they're the things that people tend to forget about and drop through a hole. So we had a process for doing that, so we got back to them.
Thanks very much. Gary Kabrick?
Thanks, Marty. And I'm going to sort of share some thoughts that were my comment letter, but also reading many of their comment letters here, I think, generally consistent with the preparers of the audit committee members here. I think as a starting point, I would recommend anything of critical importance, you know, should be documented as a very strong general rule. And going back from experience more than once in my time as a preparer and going back far enough when I was an auditor, I can assure you more than once auditors documented something in the private memoranda of the file that no one else in the room remembered, or if they did remember, they didn't agree with the conclusion. We thought the answer was left and they thought it was right or whatever. So I think if nothing else, to avoid misunderstandings, to have a shared sense of the facts of the matter, it's important to have things documented. Now, I think there's some flexibility in level of documentation. So, like an example, you know, four times a year we do our quarterly earnings review with the audit committee. I mean, they get the thing the night before, and it's a bulletized list of the things we're going to talk about, you know, reserves, taxes, cash flow or whatever, but there's no details, but at least it's memorialized that you are going to talk about these subjects. Because that's real, you know, earnings release, 10Q type release is real-time stuff. And the only thing, we have five standing meetings a year where there's a couple hours long each and the pre-read goes out 2 weeks earlier. And there's plenty of time for robust documentation. Again, I think you can take a lot of forms, a lot of levels of detail. So I would suggest if you're going to write rulemaking on this, the beginning assumption is it is documented, and maybe there's exclusions. I think of executive committees where you're talking individual staff qualifications and stuff. Maybe it's sufficient that you memorialize that the subject was discovered and not that it was discussed, but not necessarily the detail. You can probably process that in due course. But the other thing is I can truly see problems for the PCOB, for the auditors and management down the line if you allow some things to be done orally and then there's a blow-up a year or two later and there was no requirement to share this critical dialogue in writing with the audit committee or the board of directors, as the case may be, again, along the lines of there's a shared understanding of the various views of the issue and the assessment of the facts of the issue. So I err on the side of more writing is better. And again, I think some flexibility about the level of detail.
Thanks, Gary. Denny?
I obviously prefer less than 100 pages of written documents, but having said that, if there is something that's important for the auditor to communicate, I think it's well to have it be in writing. And I think specifically if something like an important accounting issue that was communicated or consulted with the national office, generally speaking, when that is the case, I ask the accounting firm or the company, usually the company, to write it up for the accounting firm so that we can have it in advance so that we can read about it before the meeting. These things are complicated, as I think Arnie indicated before, and generally speaking, if these things are just foisted upon the audit committee verbally at the meeting, the chances of the audit committee members fully understanding and being able to ask intelligent questions are fairly low. If we've had a chance to look at the material in advance and particularly then ask questions, maybe call or email in advance and ask for a little bit more elaboration if we wish to, there can be much more robust discussion and more effective discussion at the meeting. I think, Marty, the idea of having an after-the-fact follow-up with the material, in other words, having the audit committee receive the document of the accounting firm confirming the discussions kind of defeats the purpose. It seems to me that if we're going to have something in writing, those materials should go to the members of the committee in advance so that they can be part of the effective communication to lead to better discussions at the committee meetings and enhance the entire process for everyone.
Great. Thanks, Denny. Kiko?
Yeah, thank you, Marty. I'm having difficulty having sat in the room with audit committees and auditors and trying to figure out how we're going to operationalize this documentation of oral communications. It just seems problematic. Generally speaking, there's a free flow of communications. There's a lot of back and forth and questions and answers, and I don't see anybody other than the secretary taking the minutes of the meeting, you know, who's a scribe in that process. So I find it difficult to do. That being said, I'm a big proponent of having material matters in writing. I don't like this thought of the auditors going back to their desks and documenting a whole bunch of discussions they had with the audit committee and then with management and then not sharing that information. So I would caution against that. I do think the matters that should be in writing, if they were oral, if you were going to go down that path, is anything that's obviously audit related, audit conclusions, discussions about issues that they've settled in on one way or the other. And I do think that it should only be the important communications, certainly not the back and forth and casual communications that we have or we'll all have hundreds and tens of hundreds of documents to go through.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla.
Well, I think you run the risk of, if everything's in writing, of maybe reducing. One is I think you run the risk of some boilerplate with some of the more sensitive issues. And I don't think it's boilerplate around things that would already be in the work papers. And the thing that sort of comes to mind
for me that would be boilerplate might be around a discussion around your overall view of the quality of the company's financial reporting. You know, is it aggressive, ugly, whatever terms you might use. It's that sort of thing. I don't oral or written. I mean, if you're reaching a conclusion that the loan loss allowance is appropriately stated within the context of the financial statements taken as a whole, you're going to that's going to be in your papers just dead on. You're not going to be uncomfortable with reaching that conclusion. So I think it's around the more subjective areas. I think you run some risk associated with some boilerplate language around it. I don't know if that's the end of the world. We live in a legal environment where boilerplate is sort of a fact of life. If all the communications are required to be in writing, you know what? At some point, we got to stop documenting everything that occurs. I think that's excessive to say, here are the requirements, put them in writing, and then anything discussion that you have around them also has to be documented. I could see, it's just anarchy. I think I'm making almost no progress on this, but I am troubled by the writing of auditing standards meant to enhance the inspection of auditors. I don't think that's why. You write auditing standards to make it easier for your inspectors to do their work, and I'll leave it at that.
Were there any other comments? I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make one suggestion. I agree with most of what was said about the value of written communications, but would you please, as you put this together, be practical and think about the realities of spontaneous communications and the advantages of something other than a written letter reviewed and all of those things. Maybe a PowerPoint slide or two might get the job done in a particular case. Just try to keep this as general as you can, still meeting whatever objective you're trying to accomplish. And particularly, while I agree 100% with what Denny said, it's so much more effective if you have it in writing, in advance, a chance to read it. But spontaneous communication in executive sessions and elsewhere is invaluable. And the last thing you want is somebody say, well, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you about that because I have to go put it in writing and I'll send it to you next week. So allow for subsequent documentation of conversations or as much flexibility as you can if you're headed down that road.
Thanks, Mike. Arnie Hanisch?
Yeah, Marty, just one comment. And I went back in preparation for this, I went back and looked at our auditor communications that take place already. And I guess it wasn't clear to me, and I hadn't commented previously, as to what problem are we trying to fix here with this issue. Because I look at the communications that take place between our auditor and the audit committee. It's, for the most part, everything fairly detailed and in writing, in advance, goes out in advance. It covers most of what everybody's talked about here. And I guess I question what's really broken in my mind with the way the communications are today in writing. You know, there may be ad hoc communications that take place that are not part of this document that take place or that gets sent out in advance. But generally speaking, the corporate secretary will minute a lot of that at a reasonably high level as to what takes place in the course of the conversations inside the audit committee meeting. And that seems to be, at least in my mind, an adequate level of documentation. If there was something additional that was critical that maybe wasn't captured, maybe that could be incorporated inside the minutes of the audit committee by the corporate secretary. I'm just not sure why you need to have the auditors writing voluminous additional memos for the files documenting maybe what was said in an ad hoc manner. So,
Harney, just to respond to that briefly, we appreciate your comments. One of the things we considered in drafting this language was some findings that were reported in the board's 4010 report on triennially reviewed firms, and there were some instances where firms were not making all the required communications or it wasn't evidenced in any way in the work papers. So I think we tried to strike a balance between some firms that we see do a pretty robust, good presentation and a good job versus those who are not doing even what's required now.
I think I see one card and one hand up here, so in keeping with the spirit of trying to get all of these topics covered, George Munoz, and then Alex.
Just very quickly, Arnie asked about, you know, what's broken, and I think we always have to ask ourselves that, but just did the PCAOB do a study on whether the accounting firms that audit the public firms that got in trouble, whether the accounting firms had any issues with their requirements that the PCAOB oversees was part of the problem?
I'm probably not going to answer the question anyway, but I wasn't sure I understood it.
Well, okay. I guess we got a proposal before us because somehow somebody thinks something is broken or could be greatly improved, and that's why it's worth the cost and worth all these extra procedures and putting things on the agenda. So I assume, did that stem from a study that the PCAOB did in terms of the fiasco that our companies went through a year and a half ago or so?
I'd say that the standard, the proposed standard on auditor communications with audit committees reflected a number of things, and that was observations from our inspections process, observations of some of the best practices we were seeing of where there were communications with audit committees, but they weren't in our standard, but that some firms were doing, but on certain engagements, but not on all, and observations from what other standard setters were doing. So there are a variety of things that input into our thinking as to this proposed standard. So I wouldn't say there was a particular study done, but a lot of variety of factors that it influenced our thinking. Fine. Alex, you're okay? Well, thanks for the lively discussion on this topic. I think it gave us a lot of things to think about regarding a subject that doesn't sound that complex about whether it should be written or oral, but there's a lot of strong views on it and a lot of differing views and balancing, I think, that comes into play as well. So thanks for your thoughts. The next topic is audit committee responsibilities in the engagement letter. The existing PCAOB standards require that the auditor establish an understanding with the client regarding the audit. And given changes in Sarbanes-Oxley, where the audit committee was put in the middle between the auditor and the audit client for the responsibility of the auditor dealing with the audit committee, we made a proposed change in the standard that the auditor should establish a mutual understanding of the terms of the engagement with the audit committee in connection with the audit, as opposed to typically that letter was, or the engagement understanding was with management. And the mutual understanding includes communicating to the audit committee the objectives of the audit, the responsibilities of the auditor, responsibilities of management, etc. Several commenters actually stated that the mutual understanding should include the audit committee's responsibilities related to the audit as well, and that those responsibilities should be included in the engagement letter. And one commenter included in our briefing paper here on page 8 gave a number of suggestions as to what should be included in that letter. So that's the next topic of discussion, and that is, the question is, should the engagement letter include the responsibilities of the audit committee in addition to those of the auditor and management? And if so, what should those responsibilities be? And I've asked two people to address this topic, Bob Dorr and Jim Cox, and maybe Bob, you could start us off.
Sure, thanks, Marty, and actually I think this dovetails nicely with some of the prior discussion we've had around the effectiveness of two-way communication
other issues surrounding who does what in an audit and who's responsible. As we know, the proposed standard includes, among other objectives, objectives for the auditor to communicate to the audit committee the responsibilities of the auditor, and to, as Marty alluded to, establish a mutual understanding of the terms of the engagement, as well as to evaluate the adequacy of the two-way communication. Today, the engagement letter essentially lays out the responsibilities of the auditor and of management, but of course is currently void of any description of the responsibilities of the audit committee. And I hearken back to earlier today the description of the three-legged stool, and one of those legs are completely missing in the engagement letter. So in the spirit of promoting effective two-way communication, I think the question needs to be asked if whether or not a well-articulated and mutually agreed-upon description of the responsibilities of the audit committee contained in the engagement letter would actually facilitate or enhance in any way the effectiveness of the two-way communication. And if the answer to that is yes, I don't think, I'm quite sure the Sarbanes-Oxley Act doesn't go into any detail about what the responsibilities are other than for oversight of the audit process. But actually drawing from the proposed standard some of the items that were discussed there, I think the list potentially for the audit committee responsibilities is not long and not prescriptive other than, naturally to provide oversight to the financial reporting process, to inform the auditor about anything the audit committee knows that would be relevant to the audit would certainly be expected. And then getting into kind of some of the elements or criteria that were laid out that would be used in evaluating the effectiveness of the two-way communication could also be included perhaps in the engagement letter. Things like taking timely and appropriate actions and willingness to meet in the absence of management with the auditor, so on and so forth. So the question then in our mind is whether or not clearly articulated and mutually agreed upon responsibilities of all three parties in this scenario would actually enhance more effective communication. Thank you, Marty.
Thank you. Jim Cox?
Yeah, I think I can be brief. All the letters did point out what Bob was saying, and that is that all the letters commenting on the proposal, the importance of the engagement letter generally, and that the audit committee is missing from that from perhaps historical reasons. In a way, the audit committee is really not missing from that at all, because audit committees customarily have, I think the percentages are very high, a charter that sets forth what their obligations are. So when I looked at this proposal and thought about it, I was trying to figure out what would really be added by adding something to the engagement letter that was already in a charter that's at some location. The only thing I come up with is that the ritual is important, but I think that that's a momentary importance. It did make me think that that what would happen in the instance in which there was a audit of a firm that for some reason, a very small group that didn't have a charter, at which point that then I think a reasonable auditor would then ask the questions about, well, what do you envision your role as, since it's not memorialized, et cetera. And if you just visit our website, we can provide you with a charter, and we can take care of this in a nanosecond. So at the end, being an academic, I'll end on this ponderous note, and that is I'm not sure what this would really address that wouldn't be already addressed in any fashion anyway through reasonable standards. It's not clear to me that it's a problem that's broken, nor is it a problem that's really missing something, this third prong of a stool, because it's in likely the charter.
Thanks for those comments. And let's take some cards around the table. I think, George, yours was up first.
Yes, thank you, Marty. I think I question if the engagement letter, which is a contract, now includes some obligations on the part of the audit committee on a contractual basis, whether there's a potential conflict with the fiduciary duty that the audit committee has to the and this contractual arrangement that it now has with the auditor and what the real purpose of that is. And throughout this whole thing, what we have to keep in mind is that there are maybe 90% other ways that the audit committee is engaging with management, engaging with the board, engaging with other parties that the auditor is not in the loop for and does not need to be in the loop for. So somehow, you know, these requirements of reporting and communication and assessing seems to indicate as if the auditor needs to be present throughout all those situations. And I just would be cautious. I don't know what the answer is. But if there's a potential conflict of fiduciary duty with the contractual agreement, I think we have to be cognizant of that. It also sets a precedent. That is, once you include something in that engagement letter of, quote, obligation on the part, a contractual obligation on the part of the audit committee, you've opened up the door to that kind of add-ons, and it doesn't take long before the auditing, the auditors start saying, you know what, I want them on the hook, this, I want that, and next thing you know, so there's a potential conflict. Isn't the bottom line that the auditor here is supposed to be independent? That is, they call it as they see it. It's like an umpire. They come in, they do the work, they assess everything else, and they call it as they see it. There's a weakness, or there's a problem, or the audit committee is weak, there's an issue, and they report on that. And I think that's the way it should be stayed as opposed to a contract, the way it's proposed.
Thanks. Well, just to be clear, in the proposed standard, there was not a requirement for the engagement letter to include responsibilities of the audit committee. That was a suggestion that was made by several commenters to us, just to make sure that that point was clear. Roger Coffin.
Thank you. I think that the innovation in Sarbanes-Oxley to put the audit committee in control of the audit process, in my judgment, was probably one of the most significant in corporate governance in a long time. And therefore, when I approach this standard, and then what we're talking about now is this is the concept that you mentioned, Marty, of defining the roles of the audit committee in an engagement letter. I think in a perfect world, it has some attraction, and it sounds like a good idea. But the more that I thought about it, the more that I thought that the concept of the charter, for example, and which, by the way, I mean, anyone who takes a look at audit company charters will know how long and how defined they are. I mean, when I teach this in my class, I'll take a bunch of audit company charters and go through them with students, and they'll say, "You mean this is not a full-time job?" I mean, they're very lengthy. And when I think about how this might play out, and given that there are over 12,000 public companies, and thinking about what all these contracts might say, I guess I come down on that this might be a box that you might not want to go down. I think it's a fair question to ask whether or not, you know, because you do want to have this concept that's clear and delineated, the what are the roles and responsibilities of all sides. But I think you have to leave the audit committee's roles and responsibilities to the governance process, that is to say, to the shareholders, as it's set forth in their charter, subject to various, you know, other rules of perhaps the SEC or the listing standards, and leave that piece out of it for want of just getting into something that is going to cause, I think, ultimately, the PCAOB more trouble than it's worth. Thank you.
Linda Greig.
My only observation is that often these engagement letters are not actually something that's negotiated, unlike most contracts, which are negotiated and the words are worked out. You normally are handed an engagement letter by the accounting firm, and you take it or leave it. And when you try to raise comments, they're frequently rejected because this is our form. So while I think it would be a great idea if you really did have a back and forth and you sat down and the auditor said to the audit committee, I'm really expecting you to do this, that, and the other, and you actually had a meeting of the mind and a mutual agreement on responsibilities, that would be great. In the real world, that won't happen. We'll be handed the engagement letter and we'll take it. So I think I'm with Jim. We've got a charter. The charters are very robust. If audit committees aren't fulfilling the terms of their charter, like I said before, it seems to me the auditors should sit down and talk with them and say, look, we think there's some inadequacies in our communication. But I don't think this is a way to do it.
Okay, thanks. I think we've gotten some pretty clear views on that question. And in keeping with our grand plan to get us on schedule and out of here by 3 o'clock, topic 6 on management communications, which we're going to ask Gary Kubrick to lead the discussion. Gary agreed with us that we've probably covered management communications extensively this morning as our entire discussion about communications and what should be communicated by management versus the auditor. So we're zooming right past topic 6, unless there's any objections, if somebody was really waiting to get a comment out on that. And we're going to topic 7 on, I'm sorry, Larry Salvo.
Yeah, can I just ask a question? Because I noticed that in between paragraph 12 and 13, you had the note after 12 basically acknowledging things communicated by the management need not be repeated. But to the extent that management has covered anything in topic in paragraph 13, shouldn't that same guidance apply?
Larry, I think that the way it's bifurcated now leads to, we do believe what's in 13 should be communicated by the auditor, because in most instances it represents the auditor's views. And so the auditor's views should be coming from the auditor. A few of the other matters in paragraph 13 are similar to the SEC requirements. The SEC requires the auditor to report critical accounting policies and alternative treatments under GAAP, and therefore we picked up the same type of language.
So paragraph 12 was more about the financial statements, critical estimates that were in the financial statements. 13 is more about the auditor's qualitative assessment of the adequacy of disclosures and the propriety of the accounting policies given the situation in the industry, et cetera.
I guess maybe I'll take issue with that and think that just as a general matter, especially if it's a collaborative kind of working relationship between auditor, audit committee, and management, that to the extent that the management has made a presentation, and often the audit committee will turn, the audit chair will turn to the auditors and ask them if they have additional comments. That's when we hear them, and if we don't hear them, then I assume that they're going in executive session and supplementing the comments if they don't want to make them in front of me. But I just think that to the extent they're made by management, they need not be repeated.
Thanks. And I agree, we've had a lot of input today about paragraph 12 requirements and who should make those communications, and paragraph 13, so we've gotten a lot of valuable input on that during the day. Moving to topic 7, Jennifer?
Thanks, Marty. So the next and last discussion topic is on uncorrected misstatements. Just to remind everybody, the proposed standard requires the auditor to provide the audit committee with the schedule of uncorrected misstatements related to accounts and disclosures that was presented to management. We included this requirement in the standard because we believe it's consistent with the requirement of the SEC, which requires the auditor to report to the audit committee material written communications to management. And they include unadjusted differences as one of those items. In addition, although management and the auditor may have concluded that these misstatements are immaterial to the financial statements, misstatements could be material in future periods, especially to the extent they result from a control deficiency, which is not mitigated. So that's another reason we thought it was appropriate to share those types of issues for the audit committee's consideration. A number of commenters didn't object to this requirement. However, some did object to it and felt that the requirement result in providing the audit committee with too much detail on adjustments that do not have a material effect on the financial statements.
So we're seeking views on whether or not the schedule, this requirement should be included in the final standard. And we've asked Arne Hanisch to open up the discussion with his views.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'll try to be brief. And the issues that at least I see around this center more on clarification of materiality. I don't disagree at all. It's important that auditors provide a list of unadjusted misstatements, uncorrected misstatements to management as well as the audit committees. I just want to make sure that it's perfectly clear and concise within the proposal that this will be done based upon materiality levels. We all have thresholds that are provided to us. Auditors go through an analytical analysis as to what those thresholds will be, as to what would get communicated. It varies from company to company based upon the size of the company, income of the company, relative size of the balance sheet. I just believe that we need to be consistent in keeping with those levels of materiality and not necessarily encumber the audit committee with a degree of detail that would be, quite frankly, inappropriate as far as the level of some items which might be uncovered as part of the audit as uncorrected misstatements. I do believe that items that result or would have resulted in, if left uncorrected, significant deficiencies, material weaknesses, or could have suggested that there were trends from year to year, clearly need to be communicated. And that's something that I believe needs to be made clear in the statement as well with regard to the impact that these left uncorrected would have on the degree of controls relative to significant deficiencies or material weaknesses. So that is pretty much the degree of comments that I wanted to make as far as introductory remarks to try to set the stage. It's not that I would necessarily personally object. I believe that it's important to have communications of that sort to to the audit committee. It's really the degree and the amount and the number of uncorrected misstatements. And I guess one other point is I don't believe it's necessary, again, unless it would result in a control deficiency, in a significant control deficiency, to report to the audit committee those items that management has corrected that were discovered by management during the normal course of their audit. I think, quite frankly, if management finds things during the normal course, I'm sorry, not of its audit, of its closing process, to me that's a positive in the sense that management has the appropriate controls in place to detect items and has found them and corrected them appropriately. And again, unless it was pervasive and suggested that there was a control breakdown or a significant deficiency or material weakness in internal controls, other than that, I really don't believe it's necessary for an auditor to communicate those items that management has detected during its closing process.
Thanks, Arne. Jenny Beresford, do you have your card up?
I think this is a useful disclosure for audit committee members. The one thing I would ask you to consider adding in this case is some guidance on disclosures. That is, I've seen remarkable amount of inconsistency in my limited board experience on what information auditors feel they have to provide to audit committee members with respect to omitted disclosures. And I just don't think that people understand right now what the ground rules are. And in theory, I guess, if you went down the typical gap checklist, there could be scores, if not hundreds, of omitted disclosures on the basis of materiality. And that's clearly not going to be very helpful to audit committee members. But I think it is something that's not covered at all in the existing auditing standard, and I suggest that it's something that you should give some consideration to.
Can I ask a follow-up question regarding your last point on disclosures? I'm just curious if you've seen any or had any communications or best practices of how omitted disclosures would have been presented to you as an audit committee member or chair, and any suggestions in that area?
What I can say is that in one of my boards, one of the firms has simply listed omitted disclosures, said that these were ones that they thought were technically required under GAAP that were omitted on the basis of immateriality. In the other boards, there was no such listing. They just never said anything about any disclosures that were omitted. I don't know if any of the other audit committee members have seen any listings of omitted disclosures.
Thanks, Denny. Kiko Harvey?
Yes, I generally support the submission of the uncorrected misstatements to the audit committee. I think that's probably pretty common practice anyway. But on this matter of corrected misstatements, I agree that if management is identifying them as part of the normal closing process, I don't believe that those require any disclosure to the audit committee. The ones I would be a little bit more concerned about, though, are those that are caught that relate to a prior accounting period that's already been filed. Obviously, that would beg the question of whether or not that's an issue under ICFR. But I really, because of the materiality, I just don't know how that's captured in practice as well, and I would like to see some emphasis in that area.
Thank you. Just as far as your point on corrected misstatements that are picked up through the normal close process, we didn't include that as a requirement. It's just ones picked up by the auditor. So I think that's come up a couple times. George Muniz?
This is, I think, a good requirement, and that's because the audit committee is not only looking at the financial statement, the current financial statement, but it's evaluating it's evaluating management and it's evaluating the outside auditor. And so as it gets information about uncorrected misstatements or the like over time, so I would favor that it doesn't have to be material, because over time the audit committee can be in a better position to evaluate or judge the work and the interactions between management and the outside auditor, and even qualifications. So from that perspective, I would not restrict it only to materiality, but this is a good requirement.
Thank you. Gary Kabrick.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'll be quick. First of all, I echo Arnie's comments on stuff found by management in the ordinary course of the close, which will be hard to define what is an ordinary closing adjustment versus sound controls versus something that's a significant deficiency or material weakness, which probably should be brought to the auditor's attention, to the audit committee's attention. And I do support a SUD, being presented to the audit committee. We're actually hanging on the one word, the same schedule of uncorrected differences. I don't think that's, you really mean the same schedule. Looking at us as a multinational company, there's many schedules at subsidiary and business unit levels, and some of which you've got posting significance of a very small dollar to a small subsidiary because, a statutory audit report's coming versus what affects the consolidated financial statements taken as a whole. So I would be careful in the use of the word same. And then likewise, even if it's the same items, the one presented to management might be at a more granular level of detail as to what specific account number does it belong to. And again, that's sort of irrelevant at the consolidated level. So just be careful in the use of the word same. And my last comment regarding, I'll call it, disclosure omissions. The FASB, as you may know, has a project on disclosure framework and what should a disclosure framework look like. And one of the things that the working group is wrestling with is what is the answer to the question? As you know, every FASB standard, the last box said, this can be omitted. It doesn't have to be applied to immaterial items. Well, does that mean if you omit it, it's perfect, it's GAAP? Or does it mean is, no, it's still not GAAP, even if it's small, but we're just not going to make a big deal out of it? And they're wrestling with what is the answer to that question. If you say if it's immaterial, and the conclusion is it's GAAP to omit it if it's immaterial, then there is no issue. So they're wrestling with that. My only advice, Jennifer, and what it would be to sort of stick close to the FASB's project team on this. I don't know where they're going to come out, but they are working it.
Thanks, Gary. I wanted to comment on one of the things you said, which was the word same. I think you were suggesting that maybe not the same schedule needed to be presented to the audit committee as management. And the way we drafted the requirement and the proposed standard is it is the same. We were aware of some instances, have concerns or could be others, that a different type of schedule might be, you know, would be presented to the audit committee that is misleading to the, you know, that may net some of the adjustments that appear better than it really may have been or just isn't giving a true or fair presentation of what happens. So that's the reason why we use the word the same, so that that might not happen. But. Lynn Turner?
I'd just like to say I agree with what Denny was saying about a list of omitted disclosures. I think we've seen times where people that left information on pension plans out of footnotes and that type of stuff, and so requiring that I think would be helpful in addition to the unadjusted entry score sheet, which I would have just the auditor things on it. I agree with Arnie, I wouldn't throw everything on it that management finds. I think that's part of the overall internal control analysis. So
okay, thank you. Mary Hartman Moores.
Thank you, Jennifer. I just wanted to point out a couple of things that people have said, and that was I do agree that it should be included on uncorrected misstatements, and it should be provided to the audit committee, because I think that all of us have gone through, and you know, different divisions have to go through and correct or look at some of these issues and deal with it through management. And I don't know necessarily the audit committee sees the big picture and, you know, the cumulative effect. And so I think that that would be helpful, because I think it was brought up about whether or not there's some trends or pervasiveness. So I think that, you know, just seeing that, you know, it's not something that the audit committee has to deal with a lot of work with it, but just seeing that year over year, they might get that feeling of, okay, are there some issues that are underlying that need to be addressed? So I think that is important.
Thank you. Arnie?
Yeah. Jennifer, just one point of clarification, and just to make sure that I didn't misrepresent anything in my opening remarks, that we're talking about here, at least what I'm talking about are those items that are above what I'll call the threshold. That, I mean, I would hope that we're not looking to have the auditors, again, just to restate what I said earlier, that I'm hoping we're not looking to have the auditors provide whatever detailed list there might be of things that are below a certain threshold. I think it's important to, in the aggregate, maybe indicate to the audit committee what those items were. I think it's important to indicate if they were all going one way. But if they were below the threshold, and the aggregate was not above a threshold that had been established for levels of materiality, I guess it troubles me that we would provide that kind of list of what I would consider to be very immaterial, especially if it was in the aggregate below the level of materiality that had been established, either at the balance sheet level or the income statement level.
So. Our standards on evaluating audit differences, materiality, would indicate that the auditor would record those things that are above being considered clearly trivial. So if it's clearly trivial, it does not need to go on the list. But otherwise, individually in the aggregate, if it's above clearly trivial, then those type of things would be recorded. So that might help some of your concern. Hal Schroeder?
I was just going to add, having gone through that enough times in my 13 years of auditing, there tended to be some games that got played with this type of issue. Oh, well, we'll put this on the schedule. We won't put this on the schedule. What are we going to say? Is it judgment? Is it just application, is it a factual error, is it a misapplication of accounting? There are all sorts of different types of these misstatements, and I'm clearly in the camp of this is a good, at some type of summary level, telling an audit committee, we had generally these types of issues, half of them fell in the judgment, half of them fell in the systems or cutoff issues, whatever, just to give them a sense and feel, because I think it's a strong educational purpose. You know, certainly not providing all the individual layers and detail, but some high level, I think, just a good education.
Don, Nicolaus?
Yeah, I would just echo that. I think one of the things that is helpful, one of the things that's not helpful is a whole lot of data that gets provided, photocopies of schedules that are uncorrected errors and misstatements and missed omissions and whatever else that are just sort of dumped on the audit committee. It's a sort of the same thing where there's random walks through. We've got a lot of estimates, and the estimates are difficult, and it could be this or it could be that. What you're really looking for, at least what I'm really looking for from the auditor, is some interpretative guidance that says, this is meaningful. We've never seen this many errors in that have gone uncorrected in our history of our firm. You really ought to deal with this. That's helpful. To just dump them on us and say, here's a bunch of stuff that we found during our audit, and we photocopied it, and here you are, and we're required to give this to you, I'm not sure is a particularly meaningful exercise.
Don, was that a real-life experience you were?
No, but it could happen. You never know.
Charlie?
Yeah, just one follow-up comment related to disclosure, and I appreciate, Gary, your comments about FASB's project. I just want to highlight this because I think disclosure is going to become a big challenge when it comes to determining materiality. I'm not sure there's any real set rules on that, the way that we deal with misstatements and correcting numbers. And one thing about FASB, I'm not sure that FASB has the ability to actually determine what is material in that regard, even though it may present some interesting information about that. In the end, I think what a reasonable investor believes is material under the securities laws is what's going to be governing. And it's just, I want to point that out because I think this is an area that's going to be a moving target. What may have deemed to be not material as a disclosure item may actually become material in the near future.
Mary, you had a comment?
Yeah, I would just make the point in terms of a summary of past disclosures, if you will, is that I think what drives that, at least in my experience in seeing what the auditors put on our lists, are the things that are clearly not the ones that are getting there because they're immaterial disclosures, and they agree with that conclusion, and that it's not a tough conclusion to get there. It's the ones where there is a bit of judgment involved in reaching that conclusion that omitted disclosure is not significant to a potential user of the financial statements, where I think there's a judgment being made by the auditors as to what they post onto that schedule. There are clearly, like, we've taken approaches that I've discussed with the SEC staff of not making every required disclosure in our pension footnote because we have frozen pension plans and it's just not all that significant, but we make certain disclosures there, and the auditors, you know, will reference that point because that's kind of an, you know, somewhat aggressive position, not quite. I don't think it's aggressive at all. I think that's using the box at the back of the standard that says if it's immaterial, don't include it. But that makes it onto the list. There are a few minor other things that make it onto the list, but they're clearly not putting every item that shows up on the disclosure checklist where they've made a note that said it was immaterial.
Thanks, Larry. Mike?
Really quick observation on this one, but I could have made this observation on at least a half a dozen items before this, would be, I think it would be just fine to say that the auditor should reach an understanding with the chairman of the audit committee or with the audit committee on the degree of information and detail prepared here or provided here to meet the needs of the audit committee within the boundaries of the standard. And then if you wanted to go on and say in the absence of such an agreement you can or can't give the same schedule. It's true of so many things I think we've been talking about is really kind of wonder why the auditors or the standard setters for the auditors are deciding what the audit committee ought to get, as long as the standards are complied with. And I'm not suggesting anything different than that, but right in this one, just talk about it. See what it is that the committee needs and provide it. Doesn't seem too difficult.
Thank you. I think, Mike, you ended the session on that for us, and I don't see any other tent cards. We are getting close to 3, which is our closing time, so we'll move into the wrap-up section, and I'll turn it over to Dan Gelser to provide a wrap-up and summary.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Marty did have to leave early because of a family matter and asked me to do the wrap-up, but I am going to be mercifully brief. I think we've had a very busy and active day, and so the only wrap-up I would like to give is to thank everyone for their participation, for their advice, and for the ideas that you've given us. I think we certainly have a lot to think about in terms of the standard. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that there was a consensus on anything, except possibly whether the audit committee's responsibilities ought to be described in the engagement letter or not. But we certainly will carefully consider everything that we've heard here today, and I think you'll see the results of this meeting as we go forward with this project. As I said in my opening remarks this morning, I think the success of our standard setting is very much dependent upon the willingness of those who have firsthand experience in the matters that we deal with to give us the benefit of their views and advice. And from that perspective, I think this has been a very effective roundtable. So, again, thank you very much to all of you, and I will adjourn the roundtable. Thank you. Thank you.